Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And today, very exciting as always, it's a free-for-all. So if you are with us live, I would like to extend an opportunity for you to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. And that's where you'll find the chat room. We'll be monitoring that during the course of the show. And if you have some observations or some comments or even a question you wanted to, or a topic you wanted us to address over the course of the next hour, that's a great place to do it. We also have open studio lines. So if you are listening to us live, you are on the show page, and you'll see in the upper right-hand corner of the studio line, if you wanted to call it, it's 347-308-8397. Besides that, we're just going to roll right in. Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hey, Sal. How are you doing today?
Doing all right. I've got no complaints. One of the fun things about doing a free-for-all is, you put out little announcements ahead of time, and people will say, hey, why don't y'all talk about this, which I guess is a early adopter, early bird special for the join in the chat room or give us a call. And we had a couple of folks reach out to us and want to talk about the speech the Secretary of the Navy, Carlos Del Toro, did at the Kennedy School of Government. I think it was last week or week before last. Interesting commentary. So I thought maybe to kick things off, let me do a little bit of a pull quote here from it, and then we can kind of pick off from there. Anybody can look it up. Just look, SECNAV, Carlos Del Toro delivers remark at the Harvard Kennedy School, and you'll get the article right up there. But it's what's kind of nice about it, especially for regulars of Midrats. Oh, I don't want to throw my shoulder out by patting us on the back. But he talks about a lot of the things that we've been talking about here the last decade, things that Sal Mercogliano has brought up, John Conrad, Jerry Hendricks, Brian McGrath, other people that we've had on guests, these recurring things that never seem to get traction. And he brings up a term that I don't know if it's helpful, but if it gets more people attention, that's great. So I'll go ahead and start with a little bit of extended quote here for the listeners who are driving or don't have an opportunity to get the article up. So the next is SECNAV Del Toro. Extended quote follows. Quote, this afternoon I stand before you to call for a new maritime statecraft to prevail in this era of intense strategic competition. Maritime statecraft, in a broad sense, encompasses not only naval diplomacy, but a national whole-of-government effort to build comprehensive U.S. and allied maritime power, both commercial and naval. Our new maritime statecraft should be bold, founded on a strong Navy and Marine Corps to fulfill our national security interest. It should also be equally strong on engagement in areas of economic development, trade, and climate diplomacy to enable us to compete more successfully on a global scale. It should leverage the tremendous advantages we uniquely enjoy in innovation and technology, particularly in the maritime domain. Further on in the speech towards the last third of it, quote continues, as you are already aware, the People's Republic of China is building up its naval fleet at a rapid pace. In the 20 years since I left active duty, the PLA Navy has tripled in size and is on pace to have over 400 naval warships by 2030. I must also underscore to you, because it is far less widely understood, that the growth of the PRC's commercial maritime power is a development more concerning than even its naval expansion. Our nation's most prominent naval strategist, Alfred Thayer Mahan, argued that a naval power begets maritime commercial power, and control over maritime commercial power begets greater naval power. Today's PRC readership has read and studied Mahan's theory, and their actions show it. The PRC is today the world's largest builder of commercial ocean-going ships, with over 40% of the global market being built in Chinese shipyards. More concerning still, Beijing leverages its dominant commercial shipbuilding capacity and modern commercial shipyards and infrastructure to more efficiently produce its naval combatants. Chinese shipping firms have come to dominate the worldwide commercial shipping industry. They have established an ownership stake in 95 ports across 53 countries worldwide, including many of our own ports and those of our allies, unquote. Welcome to the party, but that's great to hear from the SECNAV. It'd be interesting to see what follow-on conversations that have.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun this afternoon because I started looking at this and I went, you know, I think I've heard this before. And so I started digging back into some history. And there's like a, oddly enough, the U.S. Naval Institute has it's celebrating its 150th year, and they put up some things that were high, what they thought were big moments and stuff they published. And one of them was a 1965 General Essay Prize Contest, the sine qua non of U.S. Sea Power, the Merchant Ship, by retired Admiral John D. Hayes. And he gets right into this. I mean, it is, you know, he thinks that and goes through the litany of stuff. I mean, this is 1965. At that time, he said, you know, like, I can't remember what the exact number was, but 5% or 4% or 2% of U.S. trade is being carried on U.S. ships. And, you know, his suggestion was that the only way to get attention to this matter was to get a maritime department. And we need to go back to Jimmy Drennan being on the show, I think episode 608, because he's proposing the same thing. But you got to figure that, you know, 1965 was quite a while ago. I'm not even sure Drennan was alive back then. But, you know, so none of this is new. And it is, what do you have to do to get people's attention? And in that article, Admiral Hayes points, he goes even further. There was a 1959 report called The Role of U.S. Merchant Marine in National Security. It was under a Project Walrus report. I'll have to dig out the reference to that. But it goes through the same litany of stuff. The starting paragraph of that, U.S. Merchant Marine is deteriorating. Most of its ships are nearly overaged and long outmoded, blah, blah, blah. U.S. flag shipping is carrying a steadily decreasing portion of U.S. foreign trade, 12% in 1958. You know, it is not like this has snuck up on people. And you know, we always, one of the concerns of some of these articles is we always look, the Admiral Hayes points out that we always look toward Navy and weapon systems. We should have been as a component of sea power. And this is where Secretary Del Toro gets it absolutely right. We need to look at the sea power component of our commercial shipping fleet. And he points out that the maritime strength or sea power, not nuclear weapon, is the central factor of the world in the 1960s, and I would say in the 2020s. And he goes into what the Brits were saying back in those days, but he says, our failure to conceive of sea power in its integral whole may be due to our preceptor, Alfred T. Mahan, who analyzed brilliantly its naval side but treated its mercantile aspects only in broad generalizations. I think that, you know, that is exactly what we've done. I know as a young naval officer, I never really was concerned about merchant ships. I just thought they were kind of a pain to have around because we were always trying to in this article in 1965, he says, go on board these ships. Go see what a container ship looks like. You know, and I'm beginning to see that as some of the new training comes online, some of which is being done at merchant standards, maybe we're getting young officers to pay some attention to what merchant ships are like and what they can do, and maybe that will help spread the word. But we also another part of Del Toro's speech is, you know, investment in shipyards. And I'm trying to think, well, okay, we're going to get our allies, our, you know, like who, Japan, major shipbuilder, Korea, South Korea, major shipbuilder. Are they going to invest in U.S. shipping to compete against themselves? You know, I'm having trouble with that concept. We, you know, if we're going to have it's nice to have allies, and we either need to buy some stuff from those allies, or we need to really work hard to develop our own commercial shipping construction ports and shipyards. So I like this speech. I think it covered a lot of interesting stuff, but I'm not quite sure what the what his answers are, because he's not really in a position as Secretary of Navy to do a lot of this stuff. But if the Navy Department got moved into a maritime department, boy, howdy, that would be a whole different ball of wax.
And especially if we could get it as a cabinet position, but we don't live on my planet. But I'm still thinking about the whole maritime statecraft, because statecraft means something else. But one thing, because when we've talked about this on a regular basis over a decade, we've always looked at it naturally as predominantly a national security view. And we've also covered it a little bit at an economic view. We've done both sides of the equation. You know, we had our friend from Cato over to tell us why the Jones Act is bad. And then we had a couple of our friends get the torches and pitchforks and come back and give the opposite side of the equation. But last year, I've been trying to think more, you know, how do we make this argument? How do we educate? And which is probably a good thing for a representative republic. Not everybody really thinks or cares about national security issues or understands how wet our globe is. They're more focused on domestic issues. Well, some people are making the argument, and maybe more people need to make the argument, weaving in the national security aspect. But when you look at having a merchant fleet, whether it's building it, maintaining it, putting your personnel on it, it brings in education, i.e. to like we've talked with our friend Mark Vandroff and a few other people in the industry, you know, if we gave you so many $1 million, what would you do? They would say, I'd buy 100 new welders. These are good paying jobs. These are union jobs. So not in all club places, but in many of the places. And there are people who, when they think of unions, they think of like the Service Employees International Union. That's one type of union. But we're talking about different types of unions. There are good unions out there that are closer to the European model that are interested in good jobs with good pay and good protection. And then they get their labor dues out of those good jobs with good protections. But if we increase our maritime industry to what it should be, it would put a demand signal into our education system, because we are producing a lot of people who can't get jobs with what they've spent their time and money in college in, while we have other jobs that are unfulfilled. These are good paying jobs. These are lifetime skill jobs. And it can help a lot of our other parts of the country too, which when you look at growing the fleet, you know, we're in kind of trouble right now because of industry. We can't build the submarines we want, much less maintain them. We're kind of tapped out in our other major warfare shipyards. But, you know, are there other shipyards that can build other types of ships if we want to grow our Navy? But you have to have the people who can build them. And I think Jerry Hendricks has made done some good writing that there are parts of our country, whether you're looking at the Great Lakes, the Mississippi, and its tributaries in the center of the country that has done shipbuilding in the past, but there's no demand signal here. And I've developed a new appreciation for the Jones Act, and it's imperfect in all, but it is, like SecNav Del Toro mentioned, a whole of government. It is going to be a whole of all of government, because whether you're looking at the environmental impact statements to expand or build new yards, whether you're talking about incentives at the high school, junior college and college level to focus in certain trades or educational areas that will need it to sustain that industry. I guess part of the follow-on question is, SecNav has stood up and has said his piece. Who in the government is going to stand up next to him? Who should those players be if this is going to be anything more than just another speech that slowly fades in the breeze?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, you talk about demand signal. One of the, here we are, the perfect time for us. You know, we're now going to go on another quasi continuing resolution to go till we get a budget. You know, it is, if I'm a shipbuilding company and I'm looking down the road, I would like to have contracts that are stable. If it's the Constellation class frigates, that's fine. You know, maybe we're funding those things and the work's going to continue. But if I'm looking down the road and say, okay, well, do I want to bid on what, I want to build new fast attack surface ships of some kind, how secure is that contract going to be if every year we have to go through this budget ritual and I don't know if I'm going to ever get paid or when I'll get paid? It's really hard to run a business that way.
I think, sadly, we're also going into an election year, and it's going to be hard to get anything to happen with the people who own the purse strings. And as they start to focus on their election, how do you get that national focus? There can be leadership from the executive branch, which I think, give credit where credit is due. SecNav Del Toro and his team has put the conversation forward. I think he will have to keep saying what he has said at the Kennedy School over and over to the point he's sick of saying it before he's able to get some traction. I know who the Secretary of Transportation is. If you held a gun to my head, I couldn't tell you who the Secretary of Education is. I really can't. I don't know who else in the executive branch might be able to join with this. I think there are people in Congress who understand this really well, but are they a critical mass enough to move the needle? I'm not sure. But I think everybody there is focused on the continuing resolution and the 2024 election from here. So maybe this is a 2025 issue. We'll have to see.
Yeah, I all politics is local, and the only way people are going to get this to work is if what we've done in the past, we're going to build a little bit of our spaceships in Indiana. We're going to build pieces of it in New Mexico. We're going to, that is the only way to make some of this stuff work, because of the way the people get elected. But yeah, I mean, the choice is for everybody who's interested in this, and everybody in the country ought to be interested, is to go to your politicians and say, what are you going to do about the Navy? You know, we need a big Navy, and to that point, Admiral Hayes, in his article that I put a link up to on the chat room, says people don't know. People who live in Nebraska or Iowa, they don't know about how important shipping is, or maybe they do, and we just don't emphasize that enough, so they will appreciate that when their grain gets loaded on a barge on the Mississippi River and gets floated down to New Orleans or down to Houston, that is just the beginning of why we need a strong merchant fleet and a strong Navy to keep to control the seas. And it's not, the big debate about command of the seas and control of the seas, it continues to go on, and command of the seas is something that we ought to aspire to and continue to aspire to, rather than trying to do, some kind of regional thing, which cuts back to our arguments against the way the COCOMs manage the naval assets they have and the demand signal they send out.
And there are ways too, as opposed to bemoaning the fact we're coming up in an election year, which actually is a wonderful thing to actually have elections. we can leverage that too. You know, listeners of Midrats or other people in the maritime arena, whether it's for Congress or the president or Senate, we're going to have candidates that are going to be doing town halls. They're going to be doing meet and greets. And they all, not always, but a lot of them ask, you know, do we have questions from the audience, or as they're doing the handshake line, sometimes people will take that as an opportunity to throw five words at the candidate. That's something that people are passionate with and knowledgeable of this issue. Use that as an opportunity. Both parties, this is a bipartisan effort. And yeah, that might be an interesting thing if you can have a candidate who goes, hey, in the last seven grip and grins I've gone to, I've had four people ask me about building our Navy. Where, you know, where's my military department? Let's go talk some. And people listen. You'd be surprised, you know, whether you're I don't want to use this example because it's kind of negative. I think people should be positive and upbeat about it. But it's an opportunity to raise the issue, kind of a Norman Rockwell way. But I know that there's been some candidates in my area, and I just haven't gone to it. Life is busy, but there's a critical mass out there. It's better than asking other silly issues or just being quiet.
Yeah, and I think that if since we recognize that we do recognize we've got a crisis, that some of these people in Congress ought to be suggesting, you know, to get us over the hump, we need to help our allies, like the South Koreans or the Japanese, let them help us help ourselves by letting them, you know, easing off on some of the restrictions of the Jones Act. Some of those restrictions, you know, being that every ship has to be U.S. made. Now, I don't U.S. manning. I appreciate, and I think we can get the bodies to do that. But you know, until we build up these national shipyards again, it wouldn't hurt to be able to use some of the vessels made by foreign manufacturers in our international trade.
I think one of the interesting things, we talked about this a little bit in the pre-show, I guess this is kind of a segue to move into it. You know, we don't do it with warship construction, but for instance, the Australian large deck amphib was mostly built in Spain and then was finished up in the UK. I know some European nations have had Romania and maybe Bulgaria, I could be wrong, do a lot of the fitting out there, and then they bring it back and finish it up. It's not unheard of to do that. I don't think politically you could do that here in the U.S., but there's other ways. I think AUKUS is an interesting construct, is we're trying to help Australia, a nation with just a population of a couple million more than the state of Florida, have a nuclear submarine capability. U.S. and the U.K. are going to work together with them to do that. It would be interesting to see some secondary effects of that in the nuclear industry that really Australia should have, but doesn't, considering all the uranium they have there. But that's an interesting idea on what we can partner with other nations that, if not half, a small percentage of, but boy, politically, I don't know how well that would work here.
Well, I mean, I thought the Brits, you know, they're already saying we got a $4 billion contract to work on AUKUS. You know, that's how you sell it. It's, you know, we're offering jobs. We're going to get money, and we're going to build these things, and it's important for a lot of reasons. And but also, you know, it's going to create jobs in the UK. It's going to create jobs in Australia. It's going to create jobs in the US. We need to keep banging on that. And the jobs are as you've already indicated, they're well paying jobs. It's no longer the 75 cents an hour kind of thing. It's some big bucks for people who undergo the training to learn how to weld and weld the kind of welding that needs to be done on some of these high value platforms.
Yeah, earlier today, the the British Ministry of Defense put out a nice little graphic talking about how they've moved into the design phase of the submarine for AUKUS, and there's a 4 billion pound contract, which is what, $5 billion or so? And the way they lead on it kind of folds in with our conversation. They say it's a new $5 billion contract that's been awarded to progress the program through the design and prototype phase, creating thousands of highly skilled engineering UK jobs, construction of UK's nuclear-powered submarines to primarily take place in Barrow and Furness, and advanced submarines combining world-leading sensors, design, and weaponry will be ready by the late 2030s, basically 15 years from now. Shame we can't move faster, but you know, that's how they're selling it. It's like a capability, but it creates jobs. They're skilled jobs. So it kind of folds in. It's not just a national security issue. It's not just building ties with our friends and allies, but it's creating jobs for people. And you know, if you get early in on this contract, and you could spend an entire working career almost just working on the AUKUS submarines in the UK, at least.
Yeah, and that, you know, that is the pitch that the U.S. Navy and I think the Department of Defense need to be making too, which is, you know, all we hear about in defense news sometimes is bad news stuff. You know, the barracks and some army base, and many army bases are inadequate. The berthing barges the Navy used to have, I think we just got some new ones, were inadequate. You know, all the bad news stuff. The good news stuff is that yes, we build a lot of equipment. A lot of it requires highly skilled people to manufacture it. And the skill sets that you can are available are transferable from one. You know, if you're a guy working on assembling F-18s, you know, that's transferable to when we get the next generation aircraft, the unmanned program. So you know, there's a lot of things like that people need to understand how important this is for the future of the country and the kind of benefit they get from the programs that we have, rather than the bad side of the coin, which is there are problems with the way we do things and not cleaning the barracks. I'm not sure if that was supposed to be a contractor job that failed or just one of those other types of things.
Yeah, usually those things is a sign of inattentive leadership more than anything else. Oh, well, you know, they showed up at work today, but do you know where they're living? Has anybody been there to watch them? We've all seen. That's why they're called health and welfare inspections. Like, has anybody actually looked at how they're living?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know, on board ship, we had regular daily inspections of the berthing areas. I mean, it's just part of the job.
It is. There was an interesting figure. You know, we're talking about nations sharing technology and build out. Is for those that were tracking, there's an interesting discussion. Taiwan launched its first indigenous submarine, the Haikun class, and a lot of people were arguing whether that's the best investment or not of Taiwanese defense dollars. But an interesting little nugget of that is 40% of the technology going into the submarine is not Taiwanese. It's mostly UK and US. So that's a benefit. It's also an interesting submarine too. It's 70 meters long, displaces about 2,500 tons. And for a reference mark, when you look at a real small submarine, you have the Swedish Gotland class submarine that's 60.5 meters long, displaces about 1,600 tons. Everybody knows what the Russian Kilo is. It's the same length as the new Taiwanese submarines. It's 70 meters, but it displaces a little bit more at about 3,000 tons, which seems a pretty nice-sized submarine for a nation the size of Switzerland or Moldova or stuff. It's if you look at the Taiwanese, they've had they've wanted new submarines for a long time. They had old World War II U.S. submarines. Then they got the previous generation Dutch submarines. Nobody will build them for them. They sure seem to feel the need that they need a good coastal submarine. So getting some U.S. and U.K. technology to put in it, looks like they're going to be building. I've seen one figure. They got planned to build about 8. So good for the Taiwanese.
Yeah. I never question, well, I hardly ever question the demands of people who are actually in the fight, saying, oh, you know, I could really use this, or this is, I think this is important. It's not one of those, this doesn't seem to me to be one of those dictator, I really need to have a battleship scenarios you see in the past in some countries. This has practical application for the environment they operate in.
Yeah, it's definitely not a vanity project.
I hope not.
It's kind of like the I think good people can argue both sides of the equation, but it's kind of like the ongoing argument of trying to get F-16s into Ukraine. Oh, Ukraine doesn't need F-16s. They don't need new fighter planes. Ukrainians are going, excuse me, I think we would like to have them. That would be awesome. A lot of the stuff that you've seen from Ukraine is, and I don't know how they're going to fill this gap, but something beats nothing. Maybe the F-16s can do it. I don't know. But they've used the French Scalf, I believe is how you pronounce it. I think it's the French version of the British Storm Shadow they've been launching from their SU-24s. That has really proven to be a great capability. I heard an interesting commentary that the Germans have, what do they call it, the Taurus Bull, whatever, Taurus, is a similar capability to that looking at the success they've had, the Ukrainians have had with the Storm Shadow and the Scalp, they've decided, well, we're not going to give this to the Ukrainians because it's too destabilizing, i.e. effective. I guess the Germans are a little touchy about that for some reason all of a sudden.
Yeah. I don't understand what's happened to Germany, but... that's just... They're willing to export arms all around the world that they make, except apparently to one of their neighbors or nearby neighbors. So
it's almost like we're gonna build and export tanks and self-propelled howitzers, but wait, don't use these at war. Like, well, that's why people buy these things.
At least not against countries that we're currying favor with or are dependent on for natural gas supplies or whatever. Yeah, it's bizarre.
Yeah, it's good for South Korea, though. That's who Poland is deciding, and other nations are starting to partner with to build up their forces with their K2 tank. I saw a mini documentary about how all of a sudden South Korea became such a land combat power. And it described when they were first getting into, I think it was an upgrade to the M60. In the U.S., they realized that the South Korean, little lessons learned here, the South Korean engineers were doing more than just doing what they were told, to the point they had to draw little lines down various places in the R&D department that the South Koreans could walk down and nowhere else, because they were getting a little handsy with the information. But that gave them the ability to figure a few things out that they could build what really are world-class self-propelled howitzers. I think they call it the Crab, and the K2 tank. Now, I think about my dad's generation. My dad didn't fight in the Korean War, but a lot of his peers did. That you look at what South Korea was in the immediate post-war aftermath, incredibly poor agricultural place. You look at what they've done over the course of the last 60, 70 years or so. It really, I think, puts everybody on report, going back to what we talked about earlier, that if we're going to have this maritime statecraft, if it gets some leverage and we decide that we've all heard the excuses, well, here we are, a continent-sized nation of 330 million souls. We can't build a shipyard here. We can't do this. We can't do that. You look at what the South Koreans did from literally nothing. Very little intellectual capital, almost no industrial capacity. Their capital, nothing but piles of rubble. And they really were able to build it because they had leadership, they had will, and they were able to have a consistent plan. For, you know, the had some you're covering from war. Our cities haven't been leveled in living memory. It's a shame that we don't get more effective response than we get excuses why we can't. I think it's more like we don't want to for a variety of reasons.
Well, it doesn't, you know, it depends on the needs of the party in power. And that's what kind of surprised me about Secretary Del Toro's speech is that, you know, he's indicating this is all supported by the current administration. And if it is, that's great. But you know, the focus of effort has to be on either waiving or having realistic things like environmental goals. You're going to start a shipyard, you want to make sure that you know down the road, you know, that what you do today won't 10 years from now be discovered to be a major violation of some environmental thing, which would cause you to be shut down. It's, you know, that's where the whole of government thing comes in. You really have to have this stuff vetted before you turn the first shovel. And the other side of the South Korean miracle is that they, you know, the government finances a substantial amount of their shipyards and stuff, and it is, and the same thing with Japan, for that matter. I mean, any of these countries that are doing these major projects, you know, they're spending tax money to help those industries develop. And if we're asking American business to invest in shipyards, then we better be willing to pony up either tremendous tax cuts, advantages for them, or to provide that funding that sometimes we offer and then never really come through with.
Yeah, it's kind of like the inside joke. Shipyards are infrastructure. Well, it sounds like a smart-alecky comment, but it's actually true in a few ways. You know, let's discuss a little bit about infrastructure. The interstate highway system, largely funded by the government and, you know, a few other taxes here and there, but why? There's Eisenhower liked the fact of being able to move troops real fast over the German Autobahn. It's like, hey, that'd be great to have here, but what you could make the line to say that was a subsidy to the car industry because more people were going to buy cars, to the oil industry, to the tire industry. Yeah, you could say that, but it had multiple knock-on effects, just like a revitalized maritime infrastructure in the U.S. Would it benefit your big defense contractors and other companies? Sure, it would. Would it benefit unions? Yeah, it would benefit unions, but it would also benefit a lot of people. It would benefit the nation. And I was, I recently had a chance to go through what used to be, and there's a remnant of it there, the naval base in North Charleston, which is a series of brownfield sites now. And they've converted some of the buildings there into, you know, museums or craft breweries or stuff like that. But much of that area is, and you can, if you've seen it from the air, you can see it as well. It's just, it's brownfields, it's post-industrial. You know, there are places that we can claw back some of that square footage. I think, especially in North Charleston area, if we don't do it in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll never get it back because for those who haven't been to Charleston in the last 10 or 15 years, they're building some really nice housing moving up towards North Charleston. It's changing dramatically in some areas that eventually you just won't be able to build anything there, kind of like what has happened to much of what used to be the Brooklyn Navy Yard. But I don't know where you'd be able to put new places per se, but there are former places that could be revitalized. But going back to what we mentioned before, who is going to stand up next to SecNav Del Toro and say, he said whole of government. Well, here's another part of government, and here's how we look at it. And, you know, which states are going to step up and offer, because there's some state issues if you're going to expand shipyard capacity in some places. That's what we're waiting for. I hope that there's some master plan in the president administration and in Congress that they already have a rollout plan in place. I don't think so. 51% of me believes this is just SecNav Del Toro stepping forward and putting a flag in the ground and see if anybody rallies to his banner. Perhaps that's a bit pessimistic, but I don't see any other indications.
Well, I think it would be helpful if Secretary of Defense stood up and said, yeah, you know, so this is really important, and because we can't move troops overseas without shipping and all that good stuff, and, you know, we're going to what do we always say? We're going to cut to invest. So we're going to take some money from the Army. We're going to take some money from the Army and give it to the Coast Guard and the Navy to develop some of this stuff. You know, that is the kind of support that's needed. And you know, it's not that we're going to, you know, if they could raise the defense budget, I don't know, $500 million, you know, that I don't want that. Let's make sure it's not split evenly among the services. Who needs the most money right now ought to drive some of those issues. And that, you know, Congress has a big say on that too.
Well, this is where I roll out one of my hobby horses. In a perfect world, just like it, the old phrase was, only Nixon could go to China. Only SecDef Austin could go after the Army's pocketbook to fund the Air Force and the Navy. But I don't see any indications that a former U.S. Army four-star is going to go against his service like that. Another case, an example why retired general officers and flag officers probably shouldn't be Secretary of Defense. Politicians who understand, what's that great phrase from Hunt from Red October, when I'm not kissing babies and stealing money from their back pockets, you need a little bit of the politician in that office, which unfortunately we don't have right now.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes what's the old saying? When you run out of money, sometimes you have to think. So, you know, the Marines are thinking. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of, like, the unmanned U.S. ships that have gone to Japan. The Navy's thinking, how do we use these unmanned ships? They're a lot less expensive. We don't have the personnel expenses. And I think you pointed out, you know, what's going to stop some of these unmanned things from some five guys and a crowbar? But, you know, how are we going to deal with that issue? How do we protect them? How do they protect themselves? Anyway, we've got to be pushing these. Let's assume you can't get money to build another whatever the follow-on to the Arleigh Burke is going to be, the DDGX or CGX or whatever we're going to come with next. But, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to deal with that? And I think those are the issues where we need some creative thinking. And it can be done in smaller shipyards than you know, the great big ones like the ones that are building the carriers in Norfolk or the merchant-type hulls in San Diego.
I think you brought up a good topic. We should all give a lot of respect to the Marine Corps, they have a tradition of experimentation that's that one of my favorite examples, I remember as a young man, I was reading a book about the U.S. Marines in Nicaragua before World War II, or was it before World War I? Anyway, in the early 1900s. Yeah, it would have been after World War I because of the following. This is before helicopters when they're still, you know, you had gyrocopters. And the Marines were experimenting with some gyrocopters, and they said, well, hey, we have a brush war down in Nicaragua. Send the gyrocopters down there and see what Marines can do it. And that's really kind of like what we talked about with Jerry Hendricks almost a decade ago when we land the unmanned aircraft and launched it off the end of the carrier, and then the Navy promptly hit him in warehouses next to the Ark of the Covenant, and we never to be seen again. That give them to the fleet, let them experiment. Maybe it'll be a quasi-dead end like the gyrocopters, but I think that's probably, you know, let everybody understand when the helicopter matured how that could be useful. But, you know, you mentioned the unmanned vehicles going off Japan. Just read a little bit from the article. Four unmanned ships are now operating off Japan for the first time as part of the U.S. Navy's Integrated Battle Problem 23.2 exercise aimed at folding these unmanned vessels into routine fleet operation. These unmanned surface vessels aren't operating under special protocols or extra safety measures. The USV Division I commander told reporters they are being used as fully operational tools, not experimental ones, to help manned ships conduct their missions in the Pacific as part of this exercise. End of quote. That's the way to do it. Give it to the fleet. Say, Commodore, go forward and let us know what great things you do, or tell us why it's ugly. That's nice to see. That's the way to do it, either to validate some ideas we thought would work, or to have us go back to the drawing board and a few others. It'll be very, very interesting to see the unclassified post-ex to that, if they put anything out. I'm sure the stuff behind the skiff will be really interesting, but that's the way to do it. And we need that type of iterative process where you just, like we saw during the 20s and the 30s, where they had the dirigibles, and then they had the seaplanes, and then they had our initial aircraft carriers. It's like, hey, let's just go out there and see how these things work. That's how you really find out if they're going to wind up having a gyrocopter or you're going to wind up having a dive bomber, because you just have to go out there and experiment.
Yeah, some of us have been laughing. There's a heavy lift drone that's been launching anti-submarine torpedoes. Have you seen that stuff? And
yeah.
And I go back to, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know, 50 years ago, we had that system on board ship. I mean, it wasn't perfect, but we had Dash. We had the drone anti-submarine helicopter, and that was its job, to go out and drop weapons on submarines. And then it also got creative. People would do things like put a television camera on it and use it to spot targets for off Vietnam.
Yeah.
They were using it for gunfire spotting, you know, and that program got trashed. And instead of having unmanned aircraft doing some of these missions, we started building destroyers, and we put the little Sea Sprites helicopters on there, which required a couple of pilots and a group of people to maintain them. But the Dash was theoretically indigenous to the destroyers it was on. They had special people to work on it, but it wasn't, you know, a gaggle of pilots who no offense to pilots. I happen to know a couple intimately, but they crew rest was not an issue for the Dash people.
I think long after we quit playing with them, the Japanese actually did a better job with them than we did and used them for a long time. I remember reading about the development of Dash. You know, that's for you kiddies out there, back in the day, pretty much everybody carried a nuke in addition to conventionals. You know, P-3s carried nukes, surface ships carried nukes. Everybody, nukes were all my friends, whether AAW or ASW had the old ASRock. And when they're working with Dash, there's like, hey, we could put a nuclear depth bomb on this and we could drop it. Somebody went, excuse me, you're going to put a nuclear weapon on something that could just go off of the horizon and never come back if you can't recall it? No, we're not putting nukes on Dash. So they were just going to do the conventional. But yeah, what is old is new again. And I think you hit on something there as well, is the flexibility of, you know, Dash 2, Electric Boogaloo, whatever they're calling it, I don't know. But it can carry a lightweight torpedo. It can carry a reconnaissance package. Can it carry a few hundred pounds of whatever you want it to carry? It sure can. It has some inherent flexibility. Like, I don't know whether we talked about offline or the last time we had Matt Hipple on here, because yeah, he served on an independence class, LCS. I've always said of the two, if you forced me to have one, I'd always take the LCS two, simply because it's got a lot of square footage. With square footage and spare capacity gets flexibility, because the one thing we all know is you can think you know what future conflicts and requirements will need, but that's not what they're going to be. So how flexible are you both materially and intellectually to adjust new techniques, new material, new procedures, new requirements as they reveal themselves in the course of conflict? And that big old quadcopter, I think it was a quadcopter, I can see all sorts of stuff, including, I don't know if it's related to, but it's similar to Claude Berube's latest book, The Philippine Pact, where the they were using unmanned quadcopters for to remove wounded people. Basically, you, instead of waiting for a helicopter, you take somebody, you put an IV in their arm, slap them under a quadcopter and program it, and off to the hospital they go. So there's a lot. If you can carry a lightweight torpedo, you can carry a lot of other things, and that's a real interesting capability. Again, give it to the fleet. Give them a little leeway. Give them a little money. Sailors and commanding officers, they can tell you the utility better than the theoretical guys in, at Point Magoo or over at Great Neck.
Yeah, you know, if somebody asked me when I was a young officer on board a destroyer, what would I want out of an unmanned aircraft? I would say I wanted to be able to go over the horizon and tell me what's over there so I can go MCON, and I want it to be able to talk to me securely somehow, like laser or something, so that it'll be high enough that it can transmit back to me, but it can show me things that I can't see unless I radiate and all that good stuff. And I want to be able to control that and know what's on the other, you know, around the corner, so to speak. You know, it's what Marines are doing on the ground now. They, you know, they'll carry little tiny drones and use them to see what's around the corner when they're in an op. That's terrific. That's the same thing we ought to be doing with these for shipboard use. And I assume we're doing some of that. I don't always know what's going on a daily basis, but man, I could think of all kinds of fun things to do with if I had an asset like that out at sea.
And I think one of the things, we saw that with the whole Fire Scout program, is one of the things that they were trying to hide so much is the loss rate. Because unmanned systems, for a variety of reasons, for instance, you can't troubleshoot things like you can in a manned aircraft, as things mechanically go sideways like they do, or weather appears that you didn't expect, you know, dot, dot, dot. They were really trying to hide the loss rate. I think what we've seen in the Russo-Ukrainian war that directly translates into all your unmanned systems, if you go into it knowing, hey, this is not as robust or as capable as a manned platform, but you know what? It's less expensive. I can buy more. I don't expect these to last for years, really months if I'm using them. They don't require regular certifications and qualifications. They can be designed to be, you know, taken off the shelf with a minimal amount of PMS and be ready for showtime. And that's okay. So, you know, our lightweight torpedo carrying quadcopters, if we build them to be quote, expendable, unquote. We could probably get more, cost less per unit, because if you build it thinking it's going to last 5 years when everybody knows it'll last two, you're wasting a lot of money over engineering something. I think that expendable nature is more of a benefit than anything else. Is the fact that you can send them places, and if it doesn't come back, that's okay, because as opposed to for the money I could have spent to have one Fire Scout Charlie, I've got eight of these other quadcopters. I'll just call my AW2 down in the hangar deck and tell them to prep -2, and off it goes. So I think that's you're seeing more of that too, that understanding that these things can be expendable.
Yeah, I, you know, the reason I got off on this, you were talking about the gyrocopters, you know, the because they don't, their rotor doesn't really, it's not powered. It's, I mean, the forward motion of the aircraft powers the, is what powers it, and the rotor is just a wing. And one of the problems with Dash and a lot of the other helicopter things is that helicopters are really complicated pieces of machinery. I mean, they're kind of like the bumblebee. I'm not sure they're really supposed to fly, but they do somehow. So, and that, you know, you want simplicity. More than anything else, you want simplicity. And I can see a market for gyrocopter drones. You know, you don't have to have the rotors going up. You just need to have enough power to go forward and to get the lift you need from the rotor you do have. And that, you know, I think that would be a system. By the way, the torpedo-dropping drones that they say is the size of a small car, and which is about the size of Dash, actually, and can carry up to 440 pounds.
Of course, I think we've talked about it here before. I know I've talked to Claude about it, because Claude's our resident sci-fi geek. But when we were talking about the drones that we were developing that we talked about earlier with Jerry that were, you know, now hidden with the Ark of the Covenant, and what my vision would be is we have something that we can stack up like in Battlestar Galactica, the second run of the show, had them stack up like so many potato chips, you know, just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you just pull them off the shelf and you send it off and going. That would be a great way to do it, but you've got this institutional take. You look at some of the quadcopters, even some of the larger agricultural ones, which I think this is probably derived from. I don't know if you've seen what the Ukrainians have done. These agricultural, in fact, on my hunting property last week, the crop sprayers were flying around on the cotton crop, which was fun to watch. Free air show. These agricultural copters do about the same thing. They carry a few hundred pounds of insecticide underneath and will automatically do your 80 acres just like a crop duster would. They've used those as little miniature precision bombers, taking those anti-tank mines and turning them into drop bombs instead. But they fold in the four arms that hold each of the rotors, kind of like a transformer for those who bought those for your kids, where they fold in, it becomes a very small compact package. How that scales up, I guess, is an engineering problem. It probably costs more to design it that way, but if you assume they're expendable and you want a large number, that's part of the acceleration I think we'll see out of the experience of the Russia-Ukrainian war that will directly translate into the maritime sphere, because on board ship, space is a premium.
These things are electric too, right? So the rotors on them are direct drive. You don't need all the gizmos on a like you do on a regular helicopter.
I don't know if it's a Moore's law curve or not, but the battery technology advances. You know, where is that going to be in 5 or 10 years? What range does that give you with a payload? It's a very, very interesting concept. I know big Navy ships are going toward an electric drive, so I guess your charging station for your drones would be in the hangar bay somewhere.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Or they'll just make them nuke powered.
By the way, this is another hour. I just realized we've already used up our hour. But I don't know if you've heard it as well, but, man, I got a lot of people who are talking about we need to have nuclear-powered warships again. That was part of the problem that CGX blew up, is somebody said, we're going to make this nuclear-powered. That's a lot of money. I think on the Navy side, I appreciate it. I have affection for nuclear power. It would be great to have some escorts that could follow our nuclear carriers. But unless you are willing to make the money argument on the Hill, I don't know if that's an effective investment of our time and effort, because it'll blow up in our face.
Yeah, I don't know. A lot of these, you know, now we're looking at smaller reactors. A lot of these, they're even suggesting neighborhood-sized reactors now for electricity generation. And, you know, I think there's an argument being made that some of the technology that is available is advanced beyond and I'm not a nuke, obviously, so I'm probably just talking through my hat, but as usual. But I you're just boiling water. I can't imagine you can't do that with some simple pocket-sized nuclear reactor.
Very true. But hey, I guess we're done for the hour. Did we have anything we had to talk about, or should we keep it in strategic reserve for our next free-for-all?
I think I've already overextended my knowledge base, so it's time to quit.
Well, we will do so. We'll give everybody back the rest of their day. But as always, everybody, we really appreciate you taking time to join us for Midret. And until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary.